this is Marshall Latham here once again. Yes, I'm going to encourage you to head on over to patreon.com/journeyinto and check out the early and extra stuff that I have for you over there. You can check out the various podcasts and extra episodes. And as a Patreon member, you also get every episode early. This episode of the Comics Cave, where I talk about Valerian, I was actually published on Patreon over a year ago. It was in November of 2023. And there's at least one other episode that's on Patreon that has not come out to the main feed yet, talking about an issue of the Silver Surfer. So if you'd like to check that out, head on over to Patreon. I'd love to have your support. But now on with today's Comics Cave. Welcome to the Comics Cave. Watch your step, duck your head there, and welcome to the Comics Cave, where I am Marshall Latham. I'm going to talk to you about some comic books, and I'm glad that you're here. Settle in. I'm going to try to make this episode a lot shorter than the last one. You have, like I've said before, I've been escalating these, talking about one comic to talking about three, then to four, then to seven. So yeah, I'm going back down, but these are a little bit longer too, so we'll just have to see how this goes. Today, as you can tell from the title of the podcast episode, we're going to talk about Valerian, which is a French comic book that many people have talked about over the years. I've heard people talk about Valerian and how groundbreaking it was, and how it inspired a lot of what we view as science fiction today. You know, things like Star Wars and Rish and I, in our outfield excursions, recently talked about the movie that Luc Besson made based on the characters of Valerian, the Valerian comic book. Yeah, you can go listen to that. I'm trying to keep these so that you don't have to listen to each of them, but I think it would be an interesting thing to listen to what we have to say about the movie and then learn more details about the comic. I talked a little bit about the comic there on the Outfield Excursion episode, but just brief enough to maybe contrast a little bit with what I saw in the movie. And in many ways, you know, Luc Besson did a great job, especially visually, capturing the look and feel of Valerian. But I don't know if he caught the characterization, and maybe that's not fair because I'm coming into these new. He grew up and knew these comics inside and out, and I'm just coming in as a newbie. So maybe my interpretation of that wasn't fair. But we're not here to talk about the movies now. We're in the cave. So we're going to talk about the comic book. Now, this comic book, the first episode, or the first, let me just give you some of the background. So this came out in 1967, the first story, I'll say, the first comic book came out in Pilote magazine. That's the French version of how we would say pilot, but it's pilot, I've learned. I'm trying to get some of these pronunciations correct because I don't think I did a very good job previously. So anyway, it was picked up in Pilot magazine. And I don't know, I guess what I haven't figured out is how this appeared. Like if I go through this comic, or if I go through this, so I have, there's three, there's the complete collection of Valerian comics that are in three volumes. Today, I'm going to talk about Bad Dreams that came out in 1967. And then the last one I'm going to talk about is the Empire of a Thousand Planets, which came out in 1971. And so if I start on page 51 minus 21 would be 30. So like 29 pages, and these are pretty big pages, but I guess that's about right for a comic book if this were to come out as a standard comic. But it's definitely oversized, right? It's a magazine. It's like the old magazine Conan the Barbarians that came out. You know, they were much bigger pages. You could fit more art and more words and stuff on the pages. But I guess it's about a 29 page story. So, you know, I guess in modern comics, American comics, you know, you get about 22 pages of actual comic book. But there's a lot of story here is what I'm trying to say. And I'm already babbling, so I'm sorry about that. But yeah, so I was trying to go through the basics of how this all started. So this comic book was created by Pierre Christin and Jean-Claude Vigiers. Pierre is the plotter and the words guy. And Jean-Claude is the artist. And so together they built this. They knew each other when they were young. They grew up in the town of, and I'm going to get this wrong again, Saint-Mandé, perhaps, in France. And it was during World War II, so there were air raid alerts, and they'd have to go down in the cellars and things like that. And that's where they met as boys. Later on, as they got into their, I don't know, their early 20s, late teens, they were really bored with France. Pierre called it, said that it was incredibly archaic. And, you know, there was no progress as far as culturally or technologically or socially. It was just really, according to him, narrow-minded. It was a closed nation. It was kind of rigidly structured. So, you know, no growth, no creativity. And so that's what he loved. And I can't quite tell if they left together or separately, but they came to America and kind of explored the West. It says in this, I'm reading from the brief article, I guess, here at the beginning of the compilation of the comic, but it said that they met in Salt Lake City, Utah, many years after they had met the first time. But anyway, you know, they were inspired by the things, you know, this was in the 60s when there was a lot of cultural revolution going on, right? There was, you know, coming out of the beatniks and the hippies and the, you know, there was feminism and civil rights making great strides. And just quite a revolutionary time in the United States and, you know, maybe in the world. Pierre actually had a PhD in literature and from the Paris Institute of Political Studies. And he was working in America at a university teaching French literature to Americans. And so, yeah, he had a solid job. I mean, he wasn't just here roaming the country. I'm sure he did a lot of roaming, but he also had a job, you know. And so that was kind of cool. And so, you know, with his background in literature and stuff, you know, you can tell where he's getting some of these ideas from. And then, of course, you know, in America at the time, there was a lot of, you know, the big thing was science fiction, right? You know, so they were reading, you know, like Asimov and Jack Vance and Wyndham. And I'm sure, you know, just all the big, you know, Heinlein, all those types of science fiction stuff. You know, of course, America's has a bunch of, you know, science fiction B movies at the time, you know, like Forbidden Planet or This Island Earth, things like that. You know, rock music was emerging, you know, out of the rock and roll, you know, was becoming something different where you had like Bob Dylan and, you know, lots of these, you know, rock legends from the 60s, you know, really taking root. So that, you know, inspiration comes from there. And, you know, so all this stuff comes together as inspiration. And so, out of all of this, they had the thought of putting this comic book together. You know, I'm sure late at night, they'd talk about, oh yeah, we could do this and we could do that, and that'd be fun. And then they decide to get serious about it. Some of the direct things that the creators have talked about, you know, Maggiere's likes to cite Barbarella as Laureline's spiritual grandmother. So, you know, things like that influence them. Pierre Christin talks about he owes a lot to E.P. Jacobs, who I don't know. I haven't read a lot of E.P. Jacobs. Maybe I'll have to look him up. You know, but he said that Jacobs had a lot of fantastic elements set in a very realistic atmosphere, which is kind of what we see here in Valerian. And Pierre also felt that science fiction, this is a quote, science fiction was a fantastic way of superheating reality. It was the ideal vector for alluding to large-scale changes that were affecting our contemporary world and for describing our transition into modernity. It's always a strange word to say, modernity. But yeah, you know, we know that, right? You know, science fiction is a great way to look at our current state of affairs. You know, Star Trek has done that. A lot of science fiction has done that, you know, using out-of-the-world examples to make point a home, to drive home a lesson that applies to us now in our lives and society, and, you know, whether it be racism or whatever, you know, these things can be explored in science fiction and make a point without directly offending, you know, without being in your face kind of thing. So I think he enjoyed that kind of freedom. So they ended up going back to France and struck up a deal with Pilot magazine. And and in French, bandes dessinées is, I guess, what you would refer to as a comic book. Bandes dessinées. And that's what they created in Pilot magazine. And yeah, what I was trying to say earlier was, I don't know if this like came out, if they did the entire comic story of Bad Dreams all in one issue of Pilot, or if it came out, you know, serially, like they do part of the story and then the next part would be in the next month and the next month, and maybe over the course of a year, they put this story out in Pilot magazine. That's my guess, because I'm sure, I'm guessing Pilot had other things that they were putting in their magazine as well. So they would just be monthly installments of these stories that would last for a while, I would think. I haven't been able to verify that anywhere yet. So let's get started here with Bad Dreams. So we start off here with a little bit of a history of the world in the future. So I'm just going to read this first part just as a preface to setting up the environment of Valerian here. It says, in the year 2720, Galact City, capital of Earth and the Terran Galactic Empire. Ever since the instant teleportation of matter through time and space was discovered in 2314, the concept of work has practically disappeared on the home planet. Only a few hundred agents and technocrats of the spatio-temporal service still remain an actual professional activity. The agents patrol history to safeguard it from time travel pirates and explore distant planets to secure new resources for Earth. The technocrats are scientific administrators. The most powerful of them, those belonging to the First Circle, constitute the only form of planetary or interplanetary authority. As for the rest of humanity, it indulges in the blissful habit of dreaming, under the control of the Dreams Department, which schedules the programs. Civilization seems to have reached a point of balance. Now it is 3:03 p.m. Standard Earth Time. And then at 3:04 p.m., in the Great Control Room, there's a warning that a craft has dematerialized without clearance. And they're checking through the databanks to discover more. And then at 3:05 p.m. in the offices of the Spatio-Temporal Services superintendent and his second circle technocrats. This superintendent, who's kind of the boss over all of the agents, the spatiotemporal agents. I don't think we ever hear the name of the superintendent. But the people that he works with, there's Gerard, Lurka, and Helgor. And I don't know if you really need to know that, but I just thought that was interesting. We see quite a bit here with Gerard, as you'll see as we go through. But anyway, he tells Gerard to contact the best available agent. And so we see the signal go out, Galaxity calling Valerian. And then we go to this other planet somewhere. Valerian is there and he receives the call. He's like, oh, sounds like I won't be finishing my mathematical sculpture anytime soon. And so I wish I could convey the art, and I will put some samples here with the episode. But yeah, it's just really great. You know, it's kind of cartoony, kind of comic strip-ish art. But as you keep going through these series, it really flows, and you just kind of get a sense of Valerian and how things are going. But anyway, he talks to the superintendent through a video console and tells him to put on a uniform and be there in 6 minutes exactly. And so Valerian rushes off, you know, gets dressed, goes to his space-time craft. I guess they call it a spatio-temporal craft. It instantly disappears from the planet and at the same instant shows up on Earth. And he runs in to meet with the superintendent. The superintendent's like, late by 2 seconds, you're slipping. anyway, so he sends him off on assignment, essentially. The superintendent says, the central computer has reported grave disruptions from the dreams department. And so they're going to need to go there. So all five of them, the superintendent, his three aides, and Valerian head off into this little, he calls it a bubble, but it's another little craft. And they head off to the dreams department. Said that people have been complaining about the poor quality of the dreams and that the dreams department's been sabotaged and that the dreams superintendent escaped in a space timer. And Valerian asks, who? Xombol? So Xombol is the name of this dream superintendent, and he becomes the bad guy of this story, essentially. And Valerian is sent off to follow him to the year 1000 AD and retrieve him and bring him back so that he won't disrupt time and space. And I jumped ahead a little bit, but they go to Xombol's house. And he's got all these antiques, you know, he's got an old telegraph machine, an old telephone, phonograph, and these guys don't really know what it is. Well, nobody does. They're like, oh, gee, that's curious. What the heck is that for? And you see all these things like a phonograph and a sewing machine and all those kinds of things in there. Valerian knows what some of them are because he's a space-time traveler, I guess. But Valerian finds this little alcove that's got a bunch of candles, and he finds a spell book that dates back to 1000 AD. And so that's where they know where he's gone. And it's kind of interesting, you know, he goes off to this this relay station, which is, and it's kind of got a bar. So he's talking to fellow agents at this bar about what he's doing and things that they're dealing with. And it's just kind of a fun little, it really kind of puts you in this is the day in the life of an agent, spatiotemporal agent. But then Valerian is told he can only have one drink because he has to leave. So again, he goes off into this space-time craft and he gets to this other station that's going to lead him to the 11th century. He goes to this device, he calls it a mnemonic helmet, and he puts it over himself, and it teaches him basically all the things that he needs to know, how to speak the language back then, and all the particular facts that he needs to know for that. He's also provided with clothes of the era so that he'll fit in with clothes. And then there's this huge, like, vault type door that says, now entering the 11th century. And so he goes in this, and he's in these
like catacombs or something like that. And he grabs a torch and goes through, and he comes out through like a beer barrel or wine cask or something like that. And then he goes up, and they said that there's this innkeeper who is kind of the liaison for all the space agents that need to go back to this century. And he's got a bandage on his head. He, you know, pretty much said that he was attacked by Zombul when he came through. But Valerian signs the little book saying that he's been there. And then he gives the guy a bunch of gold, because that's kind of the deal. That's why he's there, to get the gold from whenever he has to help one of these guys. He provides him a horse, and he's off to chase after Zombul. That's X-O-M-B-U-L, by the way. And as he rides away, the innkeeper or whatever kind of grumbles. He's like, "Pah, once upon a time, we had it easy in our century. Aside from wolves, rats, witches, and the occasional rain of frogs, I was mad to consort with their kind for a handful of gold. Never again." So, you know, you just learn and pick up these little things. This is how this world works. You know, they have all these little things in place and all these different places in time. But of course, they're trying to protect time and not change things. So anyway, Valerian rides his horse. And so, yeah, this now becomes like a fantasy book. You know, he's back in medieval times, or, you know, back in the 11th century. And it's all kind of a fantasy thing. He rides by these farmers out in the fields and says, "Hey, did you see somebody come by?" They said, "Yeah, he went to the dark forest." And so he rides off, even though they warn him about the dark forest, and he's going to get there after dark, which is even worse. And so he goes through the forest, but he's going to get lost, and he's losing the trail anyway. And so he makes a fire and makes a camp and lays down on these large leaves. And when he wakes up, these leaves have folded in on him as he slept, and the edges are sharp. He can't get out. Basically, he's trapped in these leaves. And then from out in the woods, he hears a voice, and it says, "I think you fell for one of the forest's traps, stranger." And this is his first introduction to Laureline. So Laureline is from this century, and she knows the ways of the dark forest. And she tells him that the forest floor is always dark, and that's why nothing grows there, and why the leaves curl in for good once they've fallen to the ground. But she takes his sword and goes up to the top of the tree and breaks a hole in the canopy, and they have to wait for the sun to come down and touch the leaf, and then it starts to crack, and he's able to escape. And so she's pretty much saved his life, right? And he thanks her. She asks him if he would like her to be his guide, because she knows about this forest. She knows about all the things that go on in this world. And so he's like, "Yeah, that would be great. Thank you." And so they go off. She wants to ride the horse. So he lets her ride the horse. And she says there's a castle they learned about this sorcerer whose name was Alberic when they were back at Zombul's den or whatever, in the future. And so he's asking about that, and she says, "Oh yeah, he's in the castle." But the castle is in the middle of the misty marshes, or sleepy marshes, I guess is what it's called. And so they go through, they travel a long ways just to get to the marsh. And she says that, you know, it's a very, you know, it's called the sleepy marsh because the mist that surrounds the marsh will make you fall asleep, and you'll never wake up, kind of thing. And so they make these huge breathing tubes, essentially, out of reeds, and they find a little raft, and they start making their way across the marsh or the swamp or whatever you want to call it, as they breathe through the reed that's up above the mist, and they're able to breathe clean air. When they get to the castle in the middle of the marshes, the reeds get too thick for them to take the raft, and so they have to walk the rest of the way. And she warns him, you know, not to burst any of the bubbles, because the bubbles contain the mist. But unfortunately, There's a dead branch that brushes against a bubble. And Valerian is able to get them both to the bank, but then they fall asleep. And a week goes by, I guess, in that time. But anyway, they wake up eventually because they got out of the mist by getting on the shore. And then they are going to go try to get in the castle. But there's this huge guard out front, you know, just a giant kind of guy. And he's got a huge mustache and he's got a mace on him, or I don't know what you call a big club with spikes at the top of it. But they're going to try to sneak in, but they step on a stick or whatever, and he comes chasing after them. But eventually they're able to get on a log, and the guy comes after them, jumps on the log, and they swing up in the air and over the turrets of the castle. And then the log knocks out the guy. And so you can see here where there's action here, but it's, again, it's kind of cartoony. And, you know, I think I've heard that, you know, these stories get more and more serious as time goes on, but I think they always keep kind of a comedic thing going as well, at least what I've read. So anyway, now they're at the top of the castle. They're trying to find their way. It's kind of a maze, you know, going through things. Eventually there's another huge dude that they have to run away from. Valerian's going to fight him, but then Loreline falls through this trap door and she's gone. He can't get her. He's going to try to save her, but the thing's coming after him. And he climbs up on a wall, but it rotates around. And then he's confronted by Zombul, who's there with another couple guys. And Zombul tells him that he knew that they'd send somebody after him. And so they had kind of set a trap. He didn't think they'd get to the castle, but he was prepared if they got there anyway. Zombul goes on a rant, you know, saying that the 28th century human race isn't worth anything. There's only a few agents that do anything. They're only good at sleeping and dreaming. And he says even the technocrats have become incapable of initiative. And so he decided to give everybody a wake-up call, and he discovered the scrolls or whatever of the sorcerer from the year 1000. And so he decided to go back and get knowledge and go back to Galaxity and save it, you know, take control of it and wake everybody up to the realities. You know, he said disrupting the dreams wasn't enough, that he was going to have to take nightmarish figures, creatures of flesh and blood straight out of our ancestors' bad dreams. And he's been learning the magic and learning incantations. And he has a scroll with all these spells. And so he's been changing normal people into monsters and, you know, his bodyguards and dragons and just all these strange creatures. They're going through kind of the dungeon where he's showing them all these creatures that he's transformed. And they run into Loreline. She is now in one of these prison cells. And Zombul says he's going to transform her. And Valerian tries to go after him. You know, he's saying, "You monster." But he gets knocked out, or not, at least knocked down by the bodyguards. And then Zombul, you know, he does spit out this incantation spell at Loreline, but instead of changing into a monster, she changes into a unicorn. And so he's like, "A unicorn? Gah, I should have remembered the manuscript. You can't transform a pure soul into just anything. Ah, never mind. She's coming anyway." And so I think that's kind of cool. It shows Loreline as a pure soul. And so she could only be transformed into something of purity, which is a unicorn. But she's forced to go with him and all of his other bad guys. And Zombul locks up Valerian in a cage that's up off the floor and locked in several places. He doesn't have anything. And he takes off. He's going to take all of his monsters and go back to Galaxity and take over the 28th century Earth kind of thing. And so he has a tunnel that goes underneath the swamp. And so they're all trying to go through, but one of the monsters is too big to make it through. And so he orders his bodyguards to force him through, but that breaks the ceiling of the tunnel and all of the swamp water starts to come in. And so they're trying to rush out in the confusion. Loreline, as a unicorn, turns around and runs back to the castle.
Meanwhile, Valerian's back in the castle trying to figure out a way to escape this hanging cage that he's in. Eventually, he looks around and in a like an old cabinet with a bunch of potions and ingredients and things like that, he sees a little vial or whatever, a little urn of acid. No, not that kind of acid. A corrosive type of acid. And so he takes off his shoelace, makes a little lasso, and drops it down. And after several attempts, is able to get the little bottle of acid and pours it on the lock, breaks out, swings over to the open window, and looks out. And right then, Loreline, the unicorn, shows up and starts talking to him. He's like, unicorns can talk? She's like, yeah, of course. So he finds his horse and they take off to go catch up with Zombul. They know that it's going to be hard. Zombul has to stop because all of his creatures are tired. So they have to camp for the night. Valerian and Loreline are able to get past them and go to the forest and lay a trap for them. And so they trap him in this huge spider web and basically force Zombul into reverting the spell and changing all of these creatures back to their human selves, including Loreline. But while everybody's getting their bearings and everything, he reads another spell and turns himself into a hawk and flies away with the scroll. Valerian's like, oh, crap, I didn't get it. I need to bring him in still. Valerian says he needs to go off after him. Loreline asks to come along. He says, no, I'm sorry, you can't. You can't follow me where I'm going. And she says, well, don't you know, unicorns can read minds. I know everything about where you're, that you're from the future and where you're from and how you got here. And he's like, holy crap, I've changed history too. So I have to bring you with me. And so from here on out, Loreline is with Valerian. This is how they met. This is how they became partners. He turns to the sorcerer, Alberic, you know, one of the, because he was one of the guys that was turned into a creature. And Alberic gives him this magic defying ring. He says, just make sure you use it before he uses his spell against you like he did on me. And then the sorcerer turns two of the guys that are standing around saying, hey, it's nice to be back on two legs again, isn't it? And then he casts a spell and turns those two guys into a horse for Loreline to ride. I say Loreline, and you might be saying, well, when Rish and Marshall talked about this comic, he said Loreline. But I've listened to several interviews with Luc Besson, directed the movie, and he refers to her as Loreline, and I think a couple other people have as well. So we were mispronouncing her name, I guess because we're not French. Anyway, so they take off. They go back to the inn. Once again, Zombul has roughed up the innkeeper that's there and gotten past him. Valerian and Loreline go down back through the catacombs, back into the relay station, and Zombul has messed up with their spacecraft, and so Valerian's going to have to fix it, and he tells Loreline, hey, why don't you get caught up on the future and all this tech? And so she goes and lays down and puts this mnemonic machine helmet over her, and she learns everything really quick about what it takes to be an agent, I guess, or all about the future. And then by that time, he's fixed it, and they take off to go back to the future, to Galax City. But it turns out that they're going to arrive 3.5 days after Zombul. So they get back to Earth in the future, and there's crazy creatures running all over the place, chasing regular humans around. It's just chaos everywhere. Gerard is there. He was able to escape, but the monsters are still chasing them. And so Valerian and Laureline take him with them and then go back to the Palace of Dreams, where Xambola is going to be crowned the Emperor of Galax City. And so they get there. They are chased by another dragon, and they have to, do some crazy maneuvering to get away from him. When they get there, Xambola is riding down through the castle on a red carpet. He's just about to crown himself. He's wearing king's clothes and all that kind of stuff. But then Valerian shows up, and Xambola says, "Well, you're persistent, but don't forget, I still have this scroll." And he starts to do a spell, and then Valerian pulls out his ring, and the spell gets turned around, reverses the spell. Everybody turns back to normal. Everything is saved, and they capture Xambola, and the superintendent grabs the scroll from him, reads a spell, and changes him into a creature, a little bird dragon thing that they put into a cage. And Laureline just looks around and says, "Oh, Galaxity is so beautiful." And that's the end. And so, yeah, quite a bit of adventure there, quite a bit of fun. Some magical spells going on, a magical ring. Like I said, it's a very fantasy episode, but it has this sci-fi premise. So I thought that was a lot of fun and kind of a neat introduction to Valerian. It's really interesting, all these things they establish, and then kind of how it develops over the years.
All right, so let's move on to our second installment here of the Valerian comic. I moved on to, I guess it's the third, I guess you could call it the third or the fourth series of comics. I'm skipping over The City of Shifting Waters and Earth in Flames, which is really two parts of a long story. Going to, I think, one of my favorite stories that I've read so far. And it's interesting, I thought this was going to be right in line with the movie. Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, because the title of this one is The Empire of a Thousand Planets. And so I thought, oh, that'll be cool. I'll read this and compare it with the movie and all that kind of thing. But even though the titles are similar, the story is completely different. There is a story, and I talked about this in the Outfield Excursions episode, but there is a story later on that was written in 1975, which was called Ambassador of the Shadows, which is directly tied to the movie, even though there's differences. But that one is really what Luc Besson was adapting. But he used, you know, similar language as The Empire of a Thousand Planets, which, you know, when you say Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, that is pretty evocative, right? So I get why he did that. And it fit right into what he did in his movie. It just didn't correlate with this story. So, yeah, let's get right into it. This is more of a science fiction story. And in reading through this a second time, I realized, wow, this really does kind of feel like a Star Wars movie or whatever episode issue. I can see where a lot of the dynamics of Star Wars could have been taken from this story. So not direct. Well, there is one direct reference, but just the feel of it, right? The space adventure kind of thing going on. So anyway, there's a lot of setup for this one because it wants you to understand the world that we're going to be visiting in this. There is a quick little, I guess, poem that starts this one out. It says, "Dark, infinite, expanse of the universe, blazing suns bathing unknown lands in light. How many billions of civilizations, how many billions upon billions of beings might call you home?" So I thought that was a nice little poem about the cosmos, I guess. So let me just read directly from the beginning of this. You know, I think each of these has their own little introduction. And I'm going to do the best with pronunciations. I've made some decisions on how these things are pronounced. So I'm just going to go with that. And, you know, again, I can't convey the art here as I'm talking to you, but I will include some samples with the episode. So here we go. In a distant part of the galaxy, one planet is the heart of a huge solar system. It is Surt the Magnificent, capital of the Empire of 1,000 planets. Surt and its fabulous imperial palace are home to the last member of a dynasty that has ruled over all the system's planets since time immemorial. Only the prince's favorites and ambassadors accredited by imperial authorities ever enter the heavy guarded palace. The people, often gathered at the doorstep of the building, hear but the echoes of mysterious celebrations. But Surt is, first of all, the greatest market of the empire. In its soaks, arrayed along the canals, one can find anything. The merchant guild roams the system to bring back countless wonders. Hypnotic shamirs from planet Glimmis, inside of which one sleeps to find oblivion. Living stones of Arful that stick to one's skin to make the most beautiful jewels. Exceedingly rare telepathic spiglicks from Bluxt, pets that live on their masters' heads and communicate to them their constant bliss. Rare metals, exotic delicacies, multicolored fabrics. In the labyrinth of Surt's streets, a population coming from all planets buys, sells, sometimes steals. One also comes to Surt to consult with the Enlightens, healers of the body and seers of the soul, inscrutable within their metal helmets. It is said that their power keeps growing, and some believe that they may become the true masters of Surt. Few in numbers, the Enlightens are the most respected and above all the most feared guests of the palace. When they are not living inside their temple fortresses, deep within the Surtan jungles. Finally, Surt is also a gigantic spaceport. Since the first days of interplanetary travel, it has welcomed ships from all over the solar system. There's no customs, no security. One comes to Surt the Magnificent, unrestrained, and leaves it freely. And heavy trade vessels, as well as light crafts, peacefully ply the sea routes between the backcountry, the capital, and the spaceport, propelled by their solar sails. On this windless planet, the boats throng the canals. And yet, despite its age and glory, Surt isn't what it once was. Everywhere, abandoned ruins, collapsed seawalls, and silted up harbors. The imperial palace itself is increasingly run down. In the jungle, where poor fishermen hunt the dangerous Marcium, a gigantic water snake for its precious skin, only the Enlightened's impregnable temples contrast with the general poverty. So there you go. There's the setup. It's kind of a long-winded explanation of this planet of Surt, which is at the center of this solar system, which has 1,000 planets, I guess, and kind of the how things work on this planet. So now we go out into space, and we are with Valerian and Laureline in their spacecraft. And in that first story of Bad Dreams, you know, he was jumping around on these little time pods and, you know, going to these different relay stations. And, you know, while some of that still exists in later stories, Valerian and Laureline get their own spacecraft. And it's the same one throughout the rest of the series. You know, Bad Dreams was the first attempt to do this. And the stories have evolved over time. And some of these elements become more common. You know, just like any other comic book, just like any other series, you know, your first story is going to catch the basic premise, but the little details change over time. And so, yeah, they have a pretty cool little space-time ship that they use that doesn't have a name or anything. It's just their ship. And so Valerian and Laureline are on a mission, and they explain what it is right up front. So, again, I'm going to quote this verbatim so you know what's going on with the story. Laureline says, "You can start recording. It's ready." And then Valerian speaks into this little recorder and says, "Hi, kids. This is Valerian, ship number XB982. We left Galaxity for the Certain System on the 23rd of September, 2720. Oral report number 4. We are now in the vicinity of CERT and have recovered the last of the Terran automatic probes that preceded our own arrival. As planned, the recordings of the CERTian speech allowed us to learn the common language by hypno-teaching. We're about ready to make the last space-time jump and land at CERT's spaceport. Nothing much to report for the moment. Over." So there you go. So basically, Earth has never, they've known about the Certain System, about this Empire of 1,000 Planets, but they've never interacted with them. And so this is their kind of their, like a little spy mission where they're going to spy or go there incognito and just see what's going on. I guess as Valerian puts it, he says, "Our job is to assess whether CERT is a danger to Earth or could become one." And Loreline's like, it doesn't appear that they can space-time jump. So, you know, if they can't get beyond their own system, it's going to take a long time for them to get to Earth. And so, anyway, he says, well, that's our mission. And so they make their last jump and land on CERT. And just as the intro said, you know, they don't experience any trouble. They just land and come out and go. The spaceport is far away from the palace and the market, the big city. So they take, you know, one of these ships to take them from the spaceport to the city or the capital. Once they get there, they start going through the market. And, you know, maybe this is what Luc Besson was thinking of when he had that interdimensional market thing in his movie. It's nothing like that here. It's pretty much, you know, just an open air market with all these things that I talked about at the beginning. And Loreline is excited to go shopping, and Valerian's kind of like, okay, fine, we can do that. She's not really interested in much. And then she finds this really nice watch. It's like a pocket watch, big pocket watch. And she really likes it. And so they buy that. And then they notice the crowd is converging in this one area. And Valerian asks, you know, a nearby villager or shopper, you know, what's going on? And the guy says, oh, is this the first time you've been to CERT? Then pay attention. This is one of the most famous of the Enlightens. Today, he's agreed to answer questions. And so they go to this huge area, and this guy dressed in robes is up front. He's got this huge metal helmet over his head. And all the Enlightens wear this huge helmet. And it's, you know, garish and huge. And I'd say, If I didn't think it would mislead you, I'd say it's kind of like Galactus's helmet, but then you're going to picture Galactus, and this guy looks nothing like Galactus. But he's got a big helmet like that, and you can't see his face or his eyes or anything. So that's kind of a Star Wars thing, right? These people wearing these huge masks over their face where you can't see their face. Anyway, so this merchant comes up and says, you know, I can't remember. Doesn't really matter what question he asks, but, you know, how am I going to do in the next 10 years kind of thing? And the Enlightened says, well, you're going to die in the next 100 days, so you better go put your affairs in order. And they're kind of watching this. And then all of a sudden, the Enlightened points at Loreline and says, come here, who are you? And she's like, me? What are you talking about? And, you know, the crowd is kind of excited because this never happens. The Enlightens never speak directly to the commoners unless, you know, they're answering one of their questions. Yeah, he stands up and he comes over and he points down to her and he says, where did you find this object? And she's like, well, here, I just bought it at the market because I liked it. He says, what is the purpose of this ornament? And she's like, well, telling time, of course. There's nothing special about that. And then the crowd just erupts in laughter. And the Enlightened turns away, doesn't say anything. He just leaves and goes off toward the palace. And they can hear the crowd murmuring a little bit. Telling time? That girl's crazy. Did you see? The Enlightened was offended by her impertinence. He's leaving. And so she's like, I guess I must have blundered somehow, but I don't know how. And so this is really strange, right? You know, yes, they've learned as much as they can about the CERT people, but evidently they didn't know enough. And so they're going to go back. You know, they figure they've bungled the mission. They've drawn attention to themselves. So they're going to get back to the spaceport. And then they realize that as they're being shuttled back, they're being followed by a couple other boats. And eventually these boats and another one overtakes them and they get captured. When they come to, they're on the boat and they're going toward one of these enlightened temples, which is just this huge, not quite pyramid, but pyramid-ish type structure somewhere in the middle of nowhere. And they're being led to this temple. And they enter this humongous door, and one of the guards activates some mechanism, and the big, huge door opens, and then it closes behind them. And this kind of reminded me of like Jabba's Palace, you know, that huge door at Jabba's Palace. And so again, I don't know if George Lucas took inspiration from this or not, but like I said, reading through this a second time, now a third time, I can definitely see some of the parallels, but it'd be interesting if somebody asked Lucas directly, you know, what are the influences from Valerian on Star Wars? Because obviously there was influence from Buck Rogers and those kinds of things. You know, we've heard that over and over and over again from Lucas. But I don't know, has he ever mentioned Valerian as a source of inspiration? Curious. I don't know. And so anyway, they're at the temple. This other inner door opens. And again, this enlightened with the big helmet and the robes comes out. And he asks her directly, are you from Earth? And they're both thinking, oh, crap. this was supposed to be a covert mission kind of thing. But then he rips the timepiece. She's wearing it like a necklace, this watch, this timepiece. And he rips it off of her and says, don't deny it. This watch and the fact that you know its purpose have betrayed you. He says, you'd have to be an earthling to buy such an object. And you'd have to be unaware that all inhabitants of the Sirtian system have an innate, perfect sense of time. Well, yeah, no one would assume that, right? He says, I don't know why you've come here, but we will soon find out. We're already inspecting your spaceship. And then Valerian says, well, you'll never get in our spaceship because I set the safety lock for self-destruct. And the Enlightened is kind of enraged by this, calls them an accursed race. Our vengeance will be terrible. He's like, vengeance? Why? We come in peace. And then the Enlightened walks away and says, that is enough. You'll remain here as prisoners. No one will ever notice your disappearance. We still need you for the moment. But afterwards, he trails off and he goes away and the door begins to shut behind him. And Valerian yells, all or nothing, Laureline. And they jump through the closing door before it closes behind them, leaving the guards kind of confused. They don't know what to do. They're not supposed to enter that area of the temple. And so they're not sure what to do. And so then Valerian and Laureline start to explore this huge temple. And they find vast rooms of technology and laboratories and all kinds of things. And they're like, man, we need to get out of here. The guards are going to find us eventually, or they're going to alert the Enlightens and we're going to get caught. And they're like, well, if there's technology, there might be a way to escape. And so they go back to this power plant area and they do find this aircraft, I guess. It's not a spacecraft, but it's like a little jet plane. Just as they're getting to this, the guards do find them, and so they hurry up and they jump in. And it's interesting, they set things up, and he's like, oh, I think I can fly this. There's a nuclear engine, there's an ejector seat. You know, he's kind of going through stuff, so ticking off boxes for future plot cues. But they don't know quite how to take off, and Loreline says, oh, it's got to be this button. So they take off and escape out of the temple. They get through this door, but then eventually these other aircrafts come after them. And again, this felt very Star Wars to me, this battle. You know, they're taking off and they're being pursued. in this spacecraft or aircraft or whatever you want to call it, kind of dogfighting. Eventually, they decide there's this huge storm coming up, and they decide to go into the storm to escape the pursuers. The pursuers back away, and then, you know, it's pretty heavy rain, and then it turns into this big, huge hail, and then they're just going through ice columns, and it's destroying the ship. He's like, we're done for. You know, so obviously, the people knew what that storm was going to become. So they hit the ejector seat, and they pop up and then land somewhere down. It's kind of this ice crystal area, and they're cold, and so they start to walk, and they said, eventually we'll get out of here. And eventually they do, and they get out into this area, and the sun comes out, and all of a sudden all these blossoms, these like spores that are in the air, blossom into flowers and all kinds of things. And they're just amazed at how weird the, weird to us, different, you know, the weather patterns are here than what they've seen before. But eventually the ice cracks, and so they get wet, but they can stand in it, and they're walking through the muddy water. And just before they get to land, this huge space snake dragon thing, the Markiam? I don't know how to... M-A-R-C-Y-A-M. Markiam. Or Marciam? I don't know what it is. But it attacks them. But before it can get them, it's hit and attacked by these huge harpoons. And remember, there's these hunters that hunt these snakes. And so it's taken down by them. They're friendly towards Valerian and Laureline. And they take him in, and they, you know, go over a campfire and give him food and give him rest. And they said, oh, we're going to market to sell these skins tomorrow. And Valerian's like, oh, can we go back with you to the capital? Because they want to get back, right? They want to investigate what's going on with the Surt people, finish their mission, because they were abducted before. And so they go into the market, and they go and they shop for these clothes, and they have very elegant clothes, and you know, like almost like royalty. And they're talking to this one merchant that's selling them these clothes, and you know, they're kind of excited. This is kind of a fun thing. You can tell there's a relationship between them. They don't outright speak of it like they did in the movie, but like when Valerian bought her that watch, she kissed him on the cheek and stuff like that. So, I mean, they're very professional, but you can tell there's a closeness between them, but it's not outspoken, right? But anyway, they're kind of excited. So they're going to try to sneak, because all these guests are going into the palace for a party or something. And so they're going to try to get in, but they get stopped at the door. Somehow there must be some reason, you know, there or some way of detecting who's a guest and who's not. And evidently they didn't make it. They go back down, and then there's this merchant that they bought the clothes from. And he's saying, yeah, I've tried that before too. It doesn't work. But then he's like, if you really want to get in there, why don't you follow me? And so they follow him, and he makes a deal with him essentially. You know, he says, oh, I'm Elmir, a humble merchant of Surt. And whenever anybody calls themselves a humble merchant, or like in Deep Space Nine, a humble tailor, you know, there's more to this character than he's letting on. But he's going to sneak him in the palace at night in these shamirs, which are like huge clams. But I guess there's a scent in them that'll put you to sleep if you're not careful. But anyway, they're going to get taken up into the palace at night. And so he's going to sneak them into these shamirs. But he says, I want some information on the Enlightens. For various reasons, I'd rather call upon strangers such as yourselves. If you manage to exit the palace again, and that part is your problem, you can find me in Black Street. If you bring me any information, I'll be able to help you again. And so Valerian's like, well, this could be a trap, but I'm going to trust this guy. And so they do. They get in these shamirs, these clams, and there's a bunch of them that are pulled up into the palace over the tower walls, you know, with these huge crane hoist things. Once it's silent And Valerian realizes there's nobody else out there. He sneaks out of his clamshell or shamir shell. But Laureline's not there. He's like, oh, this broken shell under all the others must have been hers. What happened to her? Was she hypnotized? And then there's these stairs that go up and there's lights up there. And that's where this big party is going in there. And he goes up there and there's all this light and all these people and they're drinking and talking and whatever else up there. And he's looking around. He's just amazed by everything. He's like, wow, what luxury, you know, compared to the city and the market. There's so much luxury and richness here. This lady comes up to him. Or no, I guess he walks by her. He's like, oh, would you like some Kamar nectar, traveler? And he's like, sure. He says, oh, you look surprised. Is this your first time attending an imperial party? And he's like, well, yeah, pretty much. You could say that. And then she points up to where the prince is sitting. And he notices, oh, shoot, Laureline is with the prince. And so he assumes that she's high on shamir fumes, but he doesn't know what to do to help her. And then all of a sudden, the prince's, she calls it a cupola, but it could be like, you know, I see it like this, like a box seat in a theater kind of thing. It goes dark, and so the prince has left, and evidently Laureline is left with him. But that's a signal that the party's over, and so everybody needs to go home. And he takes advantage of that confusion and goes ahead and starts exploring. He's trying to find out where the Enlightens are. And then he's like, according to the merchant's directions, the Enlightens are on this side of the palace. He doesn't really find anything, but then he sees a building like adjacent behind the palace, kind of over where he was. And so he makes his way into there and he sneaks in. Eventually, he runs into this lighted area down below because he's up on the roof. And he says, oh, look, it's a power plant, just like in the temple. He hears noises and he gets to a place or looking onto this huge courtyard or ritual area. And all the Enlightens are there and they're all gathered together. They're drinking something and they take all their helmets off. They raise these glasses high above their heads and they all say in unison, so that we live and that earth dies, which is very mysterious, right? Because nobody here is supposed to know about earth but evidently these Enlightens do. Valerian, you know, is peering over or looking at this and trying to figure out what's going on. But he moves and something triggers this big porticolis to slam down, which doesn't harm him, but draws everybody's attention toward him. So they put their helmets back on and he's captured. And when he wakes up, he's in this, I guess it's a machine, but it's and I talked about this on the Outfield Excursions episode, but it's this rectangle. And it's like he's encased in amber kind of thing. And, but he can talk and he can hear them. But he's, you know, he's trapped in this thing and they start to interrogate him or tell him that, he's going to tell them everything. He's like, I won't tell you anything. And then the Enlightened says, there's no sense in resisting. This machine isn't a torture device. It just makes people talk. It doesn't really explain anything about how, but all of a sudden, Valerian realizes he hears somebody speaking and then he realizes that it's him. The next day he wakes up, but he doesn't remember anything. He knows that he talked, but he doesn't remember what he said. He doesn't know what's become of Laureline. And then all of a sudden, these people come into the chamber and it's the prince and Laureline and a bunch of his guards. At the time, they're the only people in the room. And Laureline is saying, oh, this is the prisoner I was telling you about, my prince. Remember how you promised that you'd set him free and grant him your pardon. He's like, oh, yes, of course. But then the Enlightened comes in and says, you cannot do this. This being is dangerous. He's a threat to our empire. And so he's kind of equivocating and going to back down. But then Laureline gets on her knees and implores him again. She says, are you no longer the emperor of 1,000 planets? Are you going to yield to your advisors? And then he's like, oh, no, I'm going to honor my promise, you know, kind of thing. And so he does let Valerian go. And at this point, you know, she runs over, embraces him, gives him a big kiss. And so again, here there's this indication that they're more than just partners. There's a relationship here. The Enlightens don't know quite what to do, but they are able to leave the palace, and they go out into the streets of the capital, and they find their way. They ask somebody, and they make their way down to Black Street, because remember, that's where the merchant said he would be. But this Black Street is this like dark alley, kind of the dregs of the civilization, right? There's people laying in the streets, and it's just really moss infested and just a terrible place, really. But then they make their way through and find somebody to show them where this merchant is.
So they are eventually led to Elmir, the merchant. They knew his name. But when he comes out, he is introduced as the Grand Master of the Merchant Guild. And so they were surprised. He goes, oh, yes, I didn't tell you the whole story. And then we go through a whole lot of exposition, which this guild of merchants, you know, they've been around for a long time. They kind of oversaw all the trade. And they start to tell them of their woes, that these Enlightens didn't show up until about 100 years ago. And ever since then, they went to work getting rid of the factories and the laboratories. And I guess their medical knowledge and their psychological knowledge was much more advanced. So systematically, they started to remove the knowledge from the general public and, you know, kind of put mystical religion things in its place. And, you know, eventually they gained hold of the public and the nobility as advisors for what should be done. And then, you know, they just, all these things, you know, people forgot how to, all the spaceways, and they also started attacking merchant ships and things like that, so not as many people want to come to CERT anymore. And so they've recently found where the base, the main base of the Enlightened is. It's on an asteroid, in an asteroid field, not too far away. And there's a labor camp there, and this old crashed spaceship. And so they want Valerian's help. They'll protect him. They'll get him back on his ship. And then they want him to command this convoy. They have many other people of the Merchants Guild that are going to help them in their spaceships, as well as many that are going to take off from the planet with them. And so they strike a deal. And, well, I mean, Valerian and Lorelei don't have much choice, because, you know, he says, if you betray us, you will not leave CERT alive, kind of thing. So it's kind of it's a bargain, but they don't have much leverage in this bargain. But he says, okay, when are we going? He says, well, I need about 3 days to get things set in motion. Here's your quarters. And so then it just goes 3 days later, and he comes in, and they're all geared up for battle and things like that, and says, okay, let's go. But the implication is here is, and Valerian just has this big, huge mug of something. I don't know if it's alcohol or not, but, and they're just kind of hanging out there on the bed. And, you know, there's nothing untoward shown in the drawings, but you just have to think, okay, so they've been in this room for 3 days. they had to keep busy somehow. Anyway, so they go off. They all march, the whole guild marches through the city, goes to the spaceport, and take off. And they're able to get Valerian in his ship, and they take off, and they go into space. On their way, they are attacked. But because Valerian's ship can go through space-time, and more advanced than any of these other ships, he's able to just, you know, disappear, show up, attack a ship, disappear, you know, reappear, attack a ship, just in rapid fire. And it kind of reminded me of Star Trek Discovery, when they did that in season 1, when they needed to find out
how to get past the cloaking mechanism of the Klingons. And so they use their spore drive to do several different jumps through time and space, or space, I guess, and destroy that ship. So I wonder if the writers of Star Trek Discovery were influenced by Valerian. But anyway, so they're able to take out the convoy, and eventually they land on this huge asteroid. So we're on this asteroid, and on this asteroid, well, the other funny thing is, you know, space-time jumps, those are pretty disorienting, right? Valerian's able to make it through it, but he's struggling. Laureline is also exhausted. I think she might have even passed out a little bit, but the merchant, you know, he's never done this, so he's out for a little bit. And anyway, so on this planet, there's these, they're kind of like these giant hills, but it looks like they have faces of living beings. And there's this liquid that's running down the sides of the hills, these rock hills. And this liquid, you know, kind of looks like tears coming down the sides of their faces. And Ilmir points out that their geologist said that these were the ancient inhabitants of the asteroid and that they're slowly merging with the surface. So kind of some weird things going on there. There is a, like they were told, there was this labor camp of slaves that are from Surt that are collecting this liquid off of the hills and bringing it back to be used, I guess, by the Enlightened. And so they sneak up on this base and they surround it, and then they start shooting the guards and releasing the prisoners. And without too much trouble, they take over the labor camp. And then they approach this shipwreck. Oh, the name of the asteroid, I forgot to tell you that, is Shalom. S-L-O-H-M. Shalom is how I'm thinking that's pronounced. And they don't know quite what to do or how they're going to get in there. But eventually, a loud metallic voice calls out to them from the ship. And it says, Earthling, we're waiting for you aboard. You alone. You will be safe. And Valerian says that he's coming, that he'll join them. As he enters the ship and walks through it, it's just chaos. There's all these plants, like hydroponics plants, that have grown out of control. He sees some human and some animal skeletons. And, you know, just everything's kind of in ruins. The walls are gutted. The engines are ruined. These types of things. And he goes into the cockpit, and there's a bunch of Enlightened sitting there waiting for him in their robes and wearing their helmets. And he's like, okay, here I am. I'm Valerian. And who are you? And the main guy, I guess, says, humans like you, or miraculously what's left of them. And then in bold letters, gaze upon us since you want to know what we look like. And he takes off his huge helmet, and it's human, but his face is disfigured, I guess, due to radiation poisoning. And he explains that they were once on Earth. And he tells Valerian that the vessel was crewed by the best scientists at the time, and that they were supposed to seek out new worlds. And in order to replace Earth, you know, since it was dying, Earth was dying back then. He said, you know, its surface was devastated by nuclear explosions. So yes, I guess the Earth that we know now in the 28th century is far from a post-apocalyptic Earth. And so I guess these guys came out, and it shows a picture of them. It looks like they're like NASA astronauts, you know, wearing similar type spacesuits and stuff. Valerian says, yeah, but several missions were sent to find the ship since the advent of space-time jump. We believed it disappeared in some cosmic disaster. And Valerian's told that it wasn't completely destroyed, but they were blown off course, and they drifted towards the Sirtian system, and the hull was breached, and most of them died from radiation, or several of them survived, even though they were disfigured. And the only reason that they're alive is because of the tears, the liquid that was coming off of these hills on the asteroid. They collected it, and it provided them with what they needed to live as long as they have and to cure all ailments except for the way that they looked. And so that's what they were drinking, right, on Surt back when he was spying on them in the palace. 3 centuries they've been living. And I guess only 100 years ago is when they started to do what they were doing on Surt. But they also, you know, kind of felt betrayed. They thought that the Earth had turned them into these cosmic monstrosities, that, and they wanted to take revenge on planet Earth, which seems insensible, but I guess if you live a long time and your mind can be warped for these things. But, you know, Valerian answers. He says, well, come back to Earth. You'll be treated as heroes. And, you know, they just say that, you know, with the things that they've done, you know, pretty much Valerian wiped out most of their ships, their space-worthy ships, and they really don't belong on Surt or on Earth. And so they've set their ship to self-destruct. So they tell him that he needs to get out of there before everything blows up. And so, but before he leaves, they give him back the watch as proof that they did exist. And he says to pass on their story and let people know that they did survive. And so, you know, Valerian comes running out of the ship, tells everybody to take cover, and the whole thing blows up. So that's the end of the Enlightens on there. And then there's a lot of talk here at the end about, you know, what's going to happen on Surt. The merchant is all happy that everything is going to go back to the way it was, and the merchant guild will once again do great things. Laureline was able to contact the capital, and there's been a revolution on Surt. The fishermen, the farmers, the craftsmen, that they're storming the palace. Long-forgotten, exiled scientists have come out of hiding to lead the revolt. Other planets are rising up too. The Empire, essentially, is now being threatened. Valerian notes, he tells Elmir, you know, the Enlighteners, or the Enlightened, were able to take over the Empire so easily because it was already sick. And that, you know, there was so much, what would you call it, disparity between the palace and the people, that this rebellion is just a natural course. And Elmir acknowledges that he's right, but he wants to get back because maybe he can do something to help, and that he'll be able to maybe guide whatever provincial government is set up and all that. So anyway, they let him go back to Surt, and then they take off. They're going to go back to Earth and report on all of this stuff. And that's the end of this story. So yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's a lot of social commentary, some political commentary in this, which, you know, is of interest, right, to Kristen, who's writing all this stuff. You know, there's the stuff about the Enlightened and how they were able to take over the government. They're talking about the disparity between the Imperial Palace, you know, the royalty and the commoners. Lots of stuff in there, but it's also amid all this adventure. And so any of the political commentary, you know, is well noted, but it's also just the backdrop. It's the behind the scenes of what's going on with the action and things. And so I really like this one. This is one of the favorite ones I've read so far. You know, I think there's about 9 or 10, maybe more, maybe between all three of these collections, there's probably about 10 or 11 stories of Valerian, and that's the complete collection. But I really liked this one, The Empire of 1,000 Planets. I liked the adventure. I liked Valerian and Laureline and all the, you know, how they interacted with this strange world. And it just, I mean, it opened up so many things and neat ideas. And I don't know, I just really, really enjoyed it. And I've liked everyone I've read so far. I haven't read them all. I did read Ambassador of the Shadows, which was, and I actually liked the comic better than the movie because it was streamlined. And it was, like I said, on the Outfield Excursions episode. It was really kind of a solo Laureline. Ah, I can't get that right. It was kind of a solo Laureline story. And that was kind of fun to see her at work and on her own kind of thing. I mean, they got split up here, but we mostly stuck to Valerian's point of view when they were. I like their relationship. I like these two characters together. And it's no secret that why this was successful, why so many people have said over the years how good Valerian is, because it's really good. I'm glad that I read these comics. I'm going to read the whole collection over time here, and I think I'll enjoy them all. And maybe I'll come back here and talk about Valerian again someday here on the Comics Cave. But it won't be for a while. I have so many other comics to get to. I've talked a lot about these. I've gone into a lot of detail. But hopefully you appreciate that. Hopefully you enjoyed listening to this. And I encourage you. I mean, because I am skimming over stuff and you're not seeing the art other than what I, you know, the brief glimpses I show you in the episode. But I highly encourage you to seek out more Valerian and read it. It's really fun. And you can see the evolution of these stories as time goes on. So I will leave you now. I will let you leave the cave. Be careful on your way out once again. And we'll be back soon. And I was planning on talking about the Fantastic Four because I've wanted to talk about them from the beginning. But I think I'm going to save them because I have something planned in February that'll involve the Fantastic Four and the podcast as a whole. So I think I'm going to hold off on Fantastic Four. And I think I'm going to come back next time with a little bit of Silver Surfer, another favorite of mine from Marvel. So, be safe. This is Marshall Latham, turning off my headlamp. And I'll see you next time that you come spelunking down into the Comics Cave.
The audio from this podcast is exclusive to patreon.com/journeyinto.
The agents patrol history and safeguard it from time travel and safeguard it from time to safeguard it from time travel pirates and explore distant planets to secure new resources for Earth. And so he takes off his shoelace and is able to get the acid and he breaks out of recording. Yeah. That's fine. Is it? Yeah. Now you're on recorded.
Hi, are we recording now?
We are.
I can't believe you didn't stop it when I came in.
In the jungle where poor fishermen hunt the dangerous Markiam. The dangerous Markiam. Marcium. Markiam. I don't know how to say that. A gigantic water snake. Only the Enlightens impregnable temples. Impregnable temples contrast with the general poverty. Only the Enlightened's impregnable temples. Only the Enlightened's impregnable temples contrast with the general poverty.